Okay, we're recording?
Yes.
We're live?
Yes.
All right. And we do have quorum. Sophie will probably jump on in the next few minutes. I'm going to open the regularly scheduled Bolt meeting of Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. And I am going to read the public advisory. This meeting will be conducted exclusively through video conference and teleconference. Pursuant to Section 3 of Executive Order N-29-20, issued by Governor Newsom on May 17th, 2020, this May 5th, 2021 meeting of the Board of Library Trustees will be conducted exclusively through teleconference and Zoom video conference. Please be advised that pursuant to the executive order and the shelter in place order, and to ensure the health and safety of the public by limiting human contact that could spread the COVID-19 virus, there will not be a physical meeting location available. Now, you can join by PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, Android, and you can also dial in from a phone, 1-669-900-9128. And if you wish to make public comment using just by phone, you press 9 and wait to be recognized. You can submit an email during the meeting for public comment to bolt@cityofberkeley.info. And please be mindful that the teleconference will be recorded, as any Board of Library Trustees meeting is recorded. And all other rules of procedure and decorum will apply for Board of Library Trustees meetings conducted by teleconference or video conference. And finally, this meeting will be conducted in accordance with the Brown Act, Government Code Section 54953. Any member of the public may attend this meeting. All right. That's the public notice prior to the meeting. Preliminary matters starting with roll call. Oh, Sophie's here. Hi, Sophie. Good. That would be you, Eve.
Okay. John Soloski.
I am present.
Amy Roth. You're muted, Amy.
Not only is she muted, but she's gone.
Right.
This is what happens sometimes. Amy. All right. Why don't we go back to Amy?
Okay. Diane Davenport.
I'm here.
And Sophie Hahn.
Present.
Amy, any? Nothing. Well, I know she didn't say present or here, but she was present and here. And now it doesn't seem to be. So I don't know what to do with that.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
It's
good.
Just a video. I'm not sure what happened. I'm sorry. I am here.
Okay.
I'll work good on the video.
Okay, under preliminary matters, B, public comment and on non-agenda matters. We do have some participants here. Let me check. I'll give people a few seconds to raise a hand if you wish to speak on non-agenda matters. And I don't see any hands. Okay. comments from the library unions. Any union representative wish to speak? Again, I'll wait a few seconds. I don't see any hands. Okay. And now comments from the Board of Library Trustees. Just gonna go in the order that I see people. Diane?
Thanks, John. I'd just like to make a comment about my going to, and I think Sophie was there too, at last Friday's all staff meeting at the library, which I thought was just a terrific meeting from beginning to end. Lots of participation, lots of great explanation of what's going on by Tess. And the most moving thing to me was the introduction of the Racial Justice Advisory Group, who is a group of five that are going to be working on racial justice with us on BOLD and with the staff, with everyone involved. And each one of them made a personal comment about why they felt so personally committed to this work. And it was just stunning. And I'm so excited to be on the board of this library as it moves forward in that way. And I hope that they're going to make the BOLD work as hard as they're going to make staff work on making these changes. It's a great thing that they're doing, and I really look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Amy Roth, you are on screen too. I see you.
I'm not going to risk it. I actually have no comments at this time.
Yeah, they only give you 100 words, huh?
and then I'm gone.
Okay.
That's it.
All right, Sophie.
Well, thank you. I want to join Diane's comments about the staff meeting. It was really engaging and informative. And I also agree that the personal statements that people made about their own experiences at the library, about the experiences of people that they serve and that they encounter, were really very moving and eye-opening, and also really grateful for this process moving forward. I also wanted to let folks know that at the council meeting this coming Tuesday, May 11, during the ceremonial calendar, which happens at the very beginning of the meeting, we are going to be doing a proclamation of appreciation for Judy Hunt and for her service on BOLT. And I invite all of you to join that meeting. And if folks want to say a word or two, I'm sure the mayor will make a couple minutes for people to speak, but I do have a proclamation ready thanking her for her time and work. So hopefully you can join. And that's it. We're unfolding from the boxes that we've been in. And I'm really proud and grateful of Berkeley and how we've come through this pandemic together. And now the very, very high vaccination rates, it's just stunning. So feeling huge waves of gratitude.
Thank you, Sophie. Thank you both, Diane and Sophie, for attending last Friday, the staff meeting. I had it on my calendar and I wanted to attend. Turns out that I needed to set up a consultation with Kaiser, with my physician, so I couldn't do it. Next time. And yeah, Sophie, regarding the city and Berkeley and COVID, and it kind of does feel like we're coming out of this. And I don't want to be premature with that and give people false hopes or expectations, but it really does feel that way. We'll see. I think by mid-June, we'll really have a real sense of what's going on. So, you know, a month or so. But yeah, the vaccination rate here is high, higher than elsewhere, other places. And that's heartening for me. It's actually been one of the nice things about living in Berkeley the last year. People have taken it seriously, and I appreciate that.
I don't have anything else to add right now. We do have a presentation from Deputy City Attorney Sam Harvey. Should I turn this over to Tess or Mr. Harvey, or who's going to start this?
I would like to just personally thank Sam for attending our meeting and providing us with this orientation to the Brown Act. This was something that we discussed that would be a good idea for our team, just to be able to review the finer points of the Brown Act and have an opportunity to ask questions. And I believe that Sam is going to launch the presentation from his own computer. But I just wanted to say welcome and thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you so much, Tess, and thank you to the board for having me today. I have a brief presentation about the Brown Act, covering kind of the main points. I don't think it's designed to make anyone here a complete expert on the Brown Act. I don't know that anyone can lay claim to that title, but hopefully it'll give the board a good sense of kind of the overall rules at play with the Brown Act, and give you some tools to identify potential issues and be able to flag moments when it may be wise to reach out to city staff, reach out to our office for clarification. So I'll go ahead and launch that on my end and see if this works. Can everyone see that all right? All right. So we'll start with a little history of the Brown Act. In the early 1950s, the San Francisco Chronicle started running a series of investigative pieces about how local governments were conducting their meetings. And what they uncovered was that local governments all over the state were often doing business in secret. They were often either holding secret meetings or, in one example, the San Jose City Council was handling a contentious, complicated matter, and they said, we're just going to go in the back and sort this out. We'll come out and tell you what we decide. The argument from the jurisdictions was, hey, we're just being practical. This is the fastest way to do it. This is the easiest way to handle some of these items. But different groups around the state, having seen that report, became concerned, and the League of California Cities drafted a new open meeting law, which was sponsored by Assemblymember Ralph Brown, passed by the state legislature and signed into law by Governor Earl Warren in 1953. You'll see kind of that argument made by San Jose City Council, we're just being practical, this is the easiest way to do things, does speak to sometimes a tension when you're dealing with the Brown Act. There is sometimes a sense of, it would be easier to just have this conversation right away, it'd be easier to just send this in an email, but we have to be careful when we're dealing with public meetings that we handle things using the procedures laid out in the Brown Act. So there's Mr. Ralph Brown, and this quote here kind of speaks to the general policy behind the Brown Act, which is that the people in delegating their authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good. So the basics of the Act, the basic purpose of the Brown Act is to ensure that the public's business is done in public. And so in order to achieve that, the Act requires that all meetings of legislative bodies adhere to these basic four principles. And there are specific rules in the Brown Act about how these have to look. But basically, all meetings have to be public, open to the public. They actually adequately noticed at least 72 hours ahead of time in the case of a regular meeting, at least 24 hours ahead of time in the case of a special meeting. The city of Berkeley often, you know, has its own procedures that go beyond that to provide additional information to the public. The meeting has to stick to the agenda. You can't bring up topics on the fly if the public doesn't know what's going to be on the agenda. And then you have to allow the public an opportunity to speak on what's on the agenda, and also on any item not on the agenda, but that's within the body's jurisdiction. So you have a general public comment period at the beginning of the meeting, as well as opportunity for folks to speak on individual items. So, the Brown Act uses this term legislative body. It says every legislative body has to hold their meetings in this open and public manner. What does that mean? It's certainly the city council. It's the subcommittees of the city council. It's all the city's commission and boards, including this board. It's just about every decision-making body in the city. It's not employees, it's not one-off meetings between an employee and an individual council member, but it is, any of those bodies that you can imagine are gonna fall under the Brown Act. So the key question is, if we have these rules that say when you have a meeting, you have to have it open, you have to have it noticed, you have to provide an agenda, you have to allow public comment, the real question and where you run into Brown Act issues is when has a meeting occurred? Obviously, your ordinary public meetings are going to be publicly noticed. City staff follow the procedures to make sure all these meetings are publicly noticed. You don't have to worry about a meeting like this, not meeting the requirements of the Brown Act. But a meeting actually occurs whenever a quorum of the members of the body gather to discuss business within their jurisdiction. So a quorum is a majority of members of the body. And there's sort of any number of instances in which you could run into a majority of members of the body discussing subject matter of their board. So this could happen at social gatherings, could happen at meetings of other entities, it could happen at retreats, forums, workshops. And a big area we get questions on, and I think an area can be challenging is what's called serial meetings. So serial meetings are one of the most challenging areas of the Brown Act. And it's basically a serial meeting is when a quorum, a majority of the body, uses a series of communications, either directly or through intermediaries, to discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. So this isn't, three people on Bolt meeting in the same room. This is a series of conversations by which three people deliberate or discuss an item within their jurisdiction outside the context of a meeting. And the issue here is, just as with any kind of meeting, if it's not publicly noticed, is it deprives the public of the right to observe the meeting, participate in the meeting. So there's a couple of different ways a serial meeting can take place. The first is the daisy chain meeting. This is member A calls member B to talk about topic, and it's member B calls member C until a quorum of the body have discussed, an item within their jurisdiction and kind of, essentially met outside the context of a meeting to talk about an item. The other method is what's called the hub and spoke meeting. And this is where there's one person kind of at the center. Maybe you have one member of the board, one city council member working on a topic, and they discuss and deliberate with a majority of the body one-on-one individually with each of these people until they've sort of been at the center of a quorum of the body deliberating. The thing to watch out for here is that that person in the center of the hub in that diagram can also be a city employee. So, city officers, commission and board secretaries, department heads have to be on the lookout that they're not sort of receiving information, transmitting to another member, and then transmitting that to another member until a quorum has been, informed on an item outside of a meeting. So this is kind of, the broad look at serial meetings. The way it looks in real life is really fact specific. It can be, an email was sent to one person and then forwarded to another. It can become rather complicated. So it's something to be on the lookout for, when you're having conversations, if you have conversations with with another member of the board outside of the context of a meeting. So I mentioned, you know, emails. You know, when the Brown Act was written in the early 50s, you know, they were really thinking about in-person meetings, telephone calls, written correspondence, and you know, things like emails and texts and law forms of online communication weren't really in the picture at the time. So, you know, there's a few little, you know, pitfalls here. One is the dreaded reply all button. You may notice often you'll receive correspondence from city staff, and it won't list everyone in the to line of email. Everyone will be BCC'd oftentimes. That's to avoid a situation where someone replies to the email, accidentally replies all, and now they've sent an email to the whole body. And now we're in the situation of having to say, oh, did the body just have a meeting on this topic? that we'll have to, you know, figure out how to remedy. And then, you know, another area that's starting to kind of be looked at more, and the legislature just passed a new law at the end of last year on, is social media. So, you know, if any of you are on Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or whatever people are using to communicate about, you know, library business, there's some new rules that went into place about social media. You know, officials can communicate with the public, but they're not supposed to engage with each other on social media. So, you know, have a conversation with another member of the body via social media is prohibited now under this new rule. I think, you know, we're still kind of evaluating what do these new rules look like given every type of social media. I think just in the way the Brown Act was written without a lot of types of technology in mind, you know, a social media rule written by the legislature in 2020 may be, you know, out of date now in terms of what people are using. So it's kind of a constantly evolving thing we're evaluating, but an area to be on the lookout for. Certainly one we welcome, you know, questions and concerns from folks about how best to approach those rules. So there's a few kind of key bright line exceptions to the definition of meeting areas that, you know, you're on stable ground. One of them is an individual contact. You can always contact one other member of the body, but you have to be careful with serial meetings. Here, I guess a quorum is 3 for you. So, you know, very quickly, you can have a quorum of 3 of you. You know, you talk to one person and they kind of pass that along to a third, and now you've kind of created a quorum. So, you know, watch out for serial meetings, but you can generally always communicate with one other person about an item. Attending, you know, any kind of open or public meeting hosted by another entity. So another person, another organization hosts a public forum, and they invite a majority of you to, you know, attend. As long as you stick to what's on the schedule, you know, maybe you're on as part of a question and answer forum. As long as you stick to that portion of the schedule and aren't, you know, conversing outside of that, you're allowed as a majority to attend an event like that and communicate with the public. Another area is, social or ceremonial gatherings where a majority might, you know, be there. You could all be there in that setting as long as you're not discussing matters within, you know, your jurisdiction. And then the final area is, you know, open meetings of another body. Maybe the city council, maybe it's a county body. You know, a majority can attend, but they can't discuss items amongst themselves. You know, they're supposed to generally attend just as observers. You can attend as a majority, or you can attend and you know, provide testimony if the other body's asking you to in the context of an open meeting. So closed session, I'm not sure if this is something that comes up much with Bolt, but maybe there are a few specific areas where the legislative body is allowed to have a meeting without the public. And these are specifically enumerated in the law if there's existing or anticipated litigation. You know, if you think there might be a lawsuit on the horizon, you can meet with, you know, the city attorney to talk about that. Personnel negotiations, discussions with bargaining units are often allowed to be in closed session. Real property, you know, purchases and sales, things like that. So these are kind of specific areas where, you know, staff is usually the one who has kind of identified it as an item for closed session, and, you know, we'll agendize it appropriately. The item still has to be agendized on a public agenda, but there's specific kind of limited language you can use, right? So if there's a lawsuit pending, you don't have to write, you know, we might get sued because we messed up and now we're facing all this liability. Oh my gosh, we're in big trouble. You just write, you know, there's specific language in the law, you know, pending litigation based on XYZ that you can use to describe that matter and identify the exemption that's being used for that closed session. And then in terms of enforcement, so if someone says, you know, hey, I was at an event and there was the whole board was hanging out by the punch bowl talking about matters within their, you know, subject matter jurisdiction, and they were, you know, that wasn't an agendized meeting. I think there's a Brown Act violation here. There's a number of things that can happen. You know, a member of the public can submit a demand to cure and correct, which is a letter that it would submit to the city saying there's been a violation, you need to take steps to cure and correct. So there's, you know, the thing to keep in mind, if a violation has happened, there's almost always steps that the city can take to fix it, right? If something, if a meeting's been had in private, you know, that the substance of that meeting can be brought out in the public in an open meeting. If emails have been sent around to a quorum of the members and created a majority, you know, discussion through a serial meeting, those can be made public. You know, if a decision was made at an improperly noticed meeting, you know, the decision can be redone. So there's kind of always steps to, you know, fix what happened. Another avenue for the public is complaints to the Open Government Commission. They can review potential violations and make a recommendation to council about whether, you know, remedial steps might be necessary. And then there's some judicial remedies. There's lawsuits that can be filed. Generally, you know, a member of the public has to submit a demand to cure and correct before they file a lawsuit. So that's not something that emerges immediately. And then in extreme cases, the law allows for a criminal prosecution if there was a, you know, knowing intentional violation of the Brown Act that could be out there. It's a pretty rare thing, but it's the law provides for that. So that's it for me for the slides. I think you were given copies of those, so please feel free to review. You know, again, I don't think anyone's going to walk away sort of an expert after just a brief kind of overview, but hopefully it gives you an idea of the contours of the Brown Act a little bit. I'm happy to answer some questions now, and then, you know, if there's more kind of specific fact-specific questions about specific instances, or kind of more in-depth questions, you know, please feel free to reach out to our office, you know, either directly or through staff. Happy to, you know, chat more in depth with anyone about specific scenarios you're encountering. So thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. board members, anybody? I don't see any hands. I don't see, let me see. Sophie.
Yeah, thank you. You're quick. It took me a second to click my hand raise. First of all, I wanted to say hi to Sam and thank him. He's an amazing, relatively new addition, not that new, to the city manager, a city attorney's office. And he comes to us from a private law firm that is one of the top elections and elected office, public sector law firms in the state. So we're really lucky to have him. And I've had the pleasure of working with him on some other things, including recently. And it's just really great to have him on board. So I just want to thank him for being here and doing the presentation. There was no presentation on the Brown Act when I came on as a council member, and, you know, taking on that role of teaching board members and also staff about what we, sort of the Brown Act world that we all need to live in, which is a little counterintuitive in some ways and can also be a little frustrating because it can feel kind of anti-collaborative. But I think it's really important for us all to know about it. It is about transparency. as uncomfortable as it can be sometimes, our job is to do our work in the public eye, where people can see and hear what we're thinking, and trust that we're not sort of fixing things behind the scenes. So it is, as I said, sometimes a little cumbersome, but it serves an important purpose. So if we do have questions, you can always reach out to the city attorney's office. If you are concerned or confused, you know, can I go to this public event? Can I go to, you know, can I speak? Can I not speak? What can we talk about? If you think you may have inadvertently been in a serial meeting on an important issue, you know, Sam and the city attorney's office are really wonderful, and they've helped me through some complicated questions that I've had over time. So it's, I hope you'll come back every year. I feel like this is, whatever it was, 20 minutes, incredibly well spent. And just thank you for a really clear, crisp presentation. That was it.
Thank you, Sophie. Yeah. There have been times, the Brown Act is kind of second nature to me at this point. There have been times over the years that I've served in many capacities in the city that it did and does at times feel a little onerous, but I always remind myself that the positives far outweigh the negatives. The public has a right to know. And that's the bottom line. And without the Brown Act, I think we'd be in a heap of trouble, quite honestly. So I'm sorry, but
are we not in a heap of trouble?
Yeah, well, you know, nationally, and yes, there's internationally. Yeah, we're in a heap of trouble, but you know, that's the Brown Act takes care of a small portion of the trouble. Can't take care of everything, unfortunately. But anyway, again, thank you for the presentation. And Sophie's absolutely right. If anybody has any questions or issues or concerns, please go to the city attorney with queries, whatever. They can be very helpful, and they often are. All right. Unless there's anything else, we can move on. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Our next agenda item is the consent calendar, which is really only one item, the minutes of April 7th. Excuse me, last month's minutes. And if anybody has anything.
I was going to move approval of the minute.
Okay, move approval and adopt the resolution to approve. Yes. There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you, Sophie. So we do roll call, Eve.
Okay. John Soloski.
Yes.
Amy Roth?
Yes.
Diane Davenport?
Yes.
And Sophie Hahn?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sophie, your hand's still up. Did you have another comment, or is that from? Thank you. I'm going to, before we go to the next item, I'm checking if there's any public comment on the budget, proposed budget, or any item coming up. Well, actually, that's the only action item. I'll give people a few seconds if there's any comment. Let's see. I don't see any hands at all. but jump in if I miss something or you decide you need to comment. Proposed budget, fiscal year 2022, from Dennis Dang, our administrative and fiscal services manager. So I saw Dennis was on earlier. I think he still is. Dennis, did you want to say a few words? Tess, did you want to say a few words? How are we kicking this off?
This is Dennis. I'm trying to turn on my video. I just wanted to say, as far as an update to the budget, we haven't, Tess and I, we haven't made any changes to it since the last presentation last month. Though we do know that the PIG will be released, usually it is released at the end of April. So the State of California Department of Finance did post on their site that it's delayed till May 7th. So we will get that. And then probably a week later, we'll get the CPI. And we'll adjust the budgets then for the next meeting. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. Can you folks hear Tess?
No.
How about now? Is this better?
Yes.
Better. Yeah.
Tess, it's very quiet though.
Okay, I'll do the best I can to project. My apologies.
Okay, thank you.
So we've tentatively scheduled a meeting for May 26th, which would represent an opportunity for members of the public and the trustees to continue to ask questions or engage around the budget. And it also represents an opportunity to talk about the director evaluation, because the trustees had requested an opportunity or more time to do that. So I just wanted to mention that that May 26th meeting would be another meeting before we would be potentially voting on the budget at the regular board meeting in the beginning of June.
Good. Thank you, Tess. I think I certainly understand that. I hope folks understand that. We'll have a special meeting and then vote at our regular meeting in June to approve a budget, to send it on to City Council at that point. So board members, at this point, any questions, comments, anything? We're waiting for May 7th is Friday. So Friday or Monday at the latest, right? I assume.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think that the May 7th date is good.
Okay.
It's posted on the website.
Okay. I don't see any hands. Anybody got a hand up? No. We're good. And let me just check public. No, I don't see any hands from anybody. Wow, we're a quiet group tonight. We are moving on to information reports. We have a presentation, Transition to Online Programming. Casey Brienne, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, Erica Glenn, and Vlad Kaplan. So who wants to start that?
I'm happy to start.
Please.
All right, I'm going to share a screen here. Can you all see that? Let's see, I'm going to hit present.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So my name is Vlad Kaplan. I'm in the IT department for the library, and I'm going to talk about our transition to online programming, largely around the tech stuff. So before the pandemic, we were lucky for a couple of reasons. One is that we already had some of these cameras that we ended up using. And I think that the reason for that was Amy Reeder, who does our publicity and promotions and stuff, wanted cameras for documenting some of our in-person programming for promotions and things like that. And also in anticipation of the launch of the tool lending catalog, which we needed to document every tool for, or to take a picture of every tool for to enter into the catalog. So we had some cameras, and that was awesome. And also we had an equipment management software called Checkroom, which is different than an inventory system, which we have a separate one for that. This focuses around reservations and getting equipment around the library system. And we got it because we had a bunch of outreach equipment, like we have these foam blocks, microscopes, the Charlie cart, things that we might want to send on a particular date to a particular location, and that might need some prep work to get them there. And then we had it, of course, for AV equipment, including the cameras, maybe like audio conferencing equipment, laptops, projectors, things like that. So we had that before. So when the pandemic happened, we shut down for a while, like hard shut down, but then we came back and we started working on online programming. And initially we thought, okay, well, let's just do these children's story times and we'll live stream them to Facebook. And staff members were really terrified. They did not like this, because they had to do their story time to the camera now instead of to people, to an unknown amount of people with you know, equipment that they weren't comfortable with. And there, you know, there's an element of stage fright that is just there for doing something like that. And then ultimately we decided there was no reason to do that, and that we could pre-record a lot of the content and then just schedule it to kind of premiere. And we were using this Facebook Live feature. So we would schedule, actually, initially we weren't scheduling it out. We were just doing Facebook Live, but with the pre-recorded content. And then we had librarians come on while we were doing that and chat, you know, in the Facebook chat and talk to the public real time. And so staff relaxed around that. So figuring out what we needed. So the first thing I did was I just went on YouTube and I started looking at different YouTubers and that had a nice look to their channels. And luckily they love to talk about the equipment that they're using. So I watched a bunch of those videos. And one of the things I noticed is that the cameras that we had already bought were actually favored among many of these YouTubers. So I started to put together a list of all the different equipment we need. And then I got to talking to Heather Cummins in the central support unit, and she had some ideas around it too. And she suggested, hey, why don't we open it up? And you know, anyone that wants to say something or like recommend something can do so. So we made this big document with allowing different people to edit. You can see I put a page in here. It looks like Kelsey edited and Erica and Heather. And so everyone was just putting everything that they had heard and thought would be a good idea for doing online programming. So where we ended up. So initially we had the two cameras and then we got the third. These are 24 megapixel Canon Rebel SL2s initially and then 3s. So then we had the 3 and we were using Checkroom and moving them back and forth. And this like barely worked because they were in such high demand that no one could they couldn't ask for an extra day because it was like needed at another location. So we were like making it work, but it was like really, we were on the edge constantly. So ultimately we ended up with 7 cameras and we have one at each of the branches, one at Children's and two that are floating for kind of bigger programs if we want to do those that would have multiple angles and then later we'd be cutting those together. We purchased 2 shotgun microphones, which are microphones that sit on top of the camera and they pick up, they're like sensitive to sound in a particular direction. So those are good for not picking up as much of the room noise and like the HVAC noise and things like that. So you basically point the camera at the subject, and because the microphone is mounted on the camera, you're pointing the microphone at the subject and it picks up their voice and less of the background noise. So we got a couple of those. And then we got these two really cool we got 8 of these sets, actually. These are wireless microphones. And so there's a receiver and a transmitter. Those are the little 2 kind of cube-like things on the right. And the transmitter has a microphone built into it and it has a little clip on the back. So you can actually just clip it onto your collar and that's all you really need. And then the other end attaches to the camera, the other little cube. So, but the cool thing about that is that one, if you can see on the left here, there's like 4 handheld mics that look like just traditional interview mics. And those are just, it's just like a stick made by that same company that you clip the transmitter onto, and then you put the windscreen over it. And it, like, you basically have a handheld mic just using this little tube. And then the other thing is that you don't have to use the built-in mic for it. You can actually plug in a mic. And so we got 6 lapel mics as well, so that you can put this little cube in your pocket and then run a mic, like a more discreet, smaller mic to your shirt. And these are, of course, we could use these later on for in-person programming as well, as long as that there's an audio input in the meeting room, we can employ these for actual physical programs later on. We got a bunch of these. We haven't used them yet, I think. These are dual channel audio mixers. What they let you do is they let you hook up 2 mics at the same time to the camera, so that when you hit record and it's recording from that camera to the SD card, you have two audio sources. So if there's an interview going on, or if there's actually 2 people far apart, we can get good sound for each of them on a separate channel. We have 4 lighting kits, 3 kind of softbox kits, which have this little fabric in the front to diffuse the light. And then we have the ring light, I think it has an orange insert and a regular white insert, also just for lighting. And we got 3 backdrop kits, which I think largely are also, they haven't been super popular. I think the librarians really like showing off the library, the bookshelves and the architectural features. So we haven't used them that much, but we have them, and we have a green screen for them. And then we have a black, white, gray, and blue backdrops. And we ended up, we did do streaming programs. So not everything we're doing is pre-prepared. So we have a Zoom license. So we have like book clubs, and I think the ESL that Casey's going to talk about, and author talks that are just on the Zoom, you know, they're not pre-prepared and edited together. So we started with a 100 attendee license, and we had some really successful programs that needed more than that. And so we've upgraded to a 500. And I think we may have even temporarily upgraded to a 1000 for some kind of Berkeley Unified School District collaboration. And then to go with that, of course, we needed to get a bunch of webcams. So we got 50 webcams, and we gave out 80 laptops. So we either repurposed or the public laptops, and then we bought a couple additional. So that's really 130 cameras that exist in our system, both for internal communication and for programming needs and running these Zooms. Training. I am not a videographer and had no real experience with this equipment. So I was just going through it and learning it with the librarians. And the picture on the left there is Emma Coleman. She's one of our children's librarians. And that was one of the very, very first things that we recorded. And the fun thing about that, and coming back to like mindset, you can see that camera is plugged into a little tablet that's on the table. Because at that point, we were still kind of thinking of it as partially thinking of it as a broadcast and partially just trying to avoid video editing. So what we were doing was we had Zoom running on that tablet. And for this particular one, Michael Quende was also logged into the Zoom from Claremont branch. And they each did their performance, you know, their program in the Zoom, and then kind of cut, you know, it would cut by virtue of the Zoom just by whoever's speaking to the next person. And then, so effectively we were just using these really nice cameras as webcams at that point. I mean, it's still way better than a standard webcam, but yeah, it wasn't, you know, using its like built-in recording function. So we did that as many times, you know, I went on to these kind of training sessions. I wouldn't even call them training sessions. I just like helped record a bunch of these programs in the beginning until each librarian was comfortable with doing it on their own. And sometimes that was once, and sometimes that was 5 times. But you know, everyone got there, and we've got a lot of different librarians putting out a lot of content now. And then I should say the picture on the right is Dan Baring-Helly. He's our South branch head. And that day, Heather, he and I, we had just received all these different lights. And so we were testing out all the lights. So that's what we were doing there. And then the last part, the hard part, is the video editing. The learning curve is very sharp. And it is a time sink. So it takes a lot of time. Right now we have a handful of people doing that, and I think it's probably gonna stay that way. Again, some people took to it immediately, and some people needed some handholding, but were enthusiastic and got there. And that is what I have to say about the rollout for online programming. Thank you.
Thank you, Vlad. Pretty cool equipment there. Thanks for the, I didn't know we had that stuff. That's great. All right. There are a couple other people on this presentation. Casey, Brienne, say your last name for me.
Brian.
Brian.
Yeah.
Pretty easy. Okay.
And I can absolutely go next. Let me just share my screen. Give me 1 second. So I'm going to talk about taking an actual live in-person program and turning it to the digital platform. I in-person hosted the ESL Conversation Club at Central. We had that both at Central and at West. So we had it twice a week. Our original platform was five tables. We had a topic presentation, and then we'd all break out the little tables and have individual group discussions that we would rotate between. So in June of 2020, Linda Sakamoto-Jonke and I, we started brainstorming how we could move from that format to a Zoom platform. Because right now we did have problems where a lot of our patrons that we usually had, such as visiting scholars, local language schools, and adult schools, obviously, they were gone. So we tried to move to the online platform. So Linda and I first started reaching out to other libraries in the area, and a lot of them were really kind, and we started asking if we can, you know, find out about their process to starting these groups online. A lot of them allowed us to sit in on a meeting. The Monrovia Public Library did such a great job of letting us, we sat in on a few of their live sessions. They gave us all of their background. From what we found, a lot of these ESL Conversations clubs had their own personality, but they were very static, very classroom setting almost, because it would be a group of people on a Zoom. There would be questions, but it would be this big, large group that just almost seemed like a class rather than a club that was something fun. And we kind of wanted it to be more like our old format where we had all these tables, different leads. That way we had really engaging conversations. So unfortunately we had the Zoom platform and we had, neither of us had ever really used Zoom other than we had like one or two workshops beforehand. So we went into Zoom knowing nothing. We spent about, I think at the start we spent about 12 or 13 hours learning how to do Zoom and how to do breakout rooms just by Googling. We would practice, we actually would set up, we'd have an iPad, a phone, about two laptops to create about six people in the Zoom, which was mostly just Linda and I and our faces just sitting there talking to ourselves, trying to figure out how we can replicate these rooms. Eventually we were able to figure out that we could create these breakout rooms and we could just move the leads rather than have everyone move between them. So to reformat this, we reached back out to our leads. Before we had a combination of staff as well as volunteer leads that had helped us before. All of the people that we reached out to were so excited to help. Though, when we told them what we were doing with the breakout rooms, everyone was very nervous because most people had not had the experience of breakout rooms. So we actually invited about 10 members of our in-person ESL Conversation Club to join us for some practice runs. That was the first instance where we really got an idea that things had changed since the pandemic. We had about 10 people, and one of them, when we were going around and discussing things, we had said good morning, and it turned out it was 2 a.m. He was in Sweden joining us. So that was a big shock all of a sudden. And so we thought that was great. So we ran that it was really good that we had the test group, because when we were doing that, we were still new. So you'd be talking to somebody and all of a sudden they would go flying out of the room and nobody would have any idea what's happened. But that was one of the reasons why we handpicked those first 10, because they went along with it. It was great. And eventually we opened it up to our email tree, because we had this weekly newsletter that we had sent out before. So we opened it up. There was probably about 150 that we sent it out to. And in our first group, we got about 20 people already. And again, it was very interesting because when we got this, not all of them were in California. We had some that had called in from Japan, from China. One person that called in from Japan said this, they had been a visiting scholar that had been joining us. And they said that was the first time they had spoken English since the pandemic started. So we started doing it twice a week. So we moved it to this, in September is when we opened it up. We were doing it Wednesdays at 4 o'clock. And we got a great group. It was a mix of people that was from before, as well as new people. We probably have, in the first month, we probably had about half of our group were new ESL members. In fact, back in, and it has only grown since then, with all the schools opening up, we had to, in fact, add a second date on Tuesdays at 10:30 a.m. because it was so popular. We're averaging about 20 patrons per meeting. And I would say roughly a third of those are patrons from outside the United States. And about half of those are former ESL members that were in our in-person group that had to return to their home countries, but felt connected still to the Berkeley Public Library through these newsletters that we were sending out. That some of them wake up at 2 in the morning. Some people have coffee with us at our 4 o'clock meeting. And they all join in. We've had members from countries from Uzbekistan. We had a student from Uzbekistan that was joining us at 4 a.m. Because he was studying to get into the language test for MIT. We have a patron from Vietnam that joins us twice a week, once at 2 in the morning and once at 8 in the morning for her. And she, every Wednesday, she will show us her classroom in Vietnam before she teaches. We've had the Republic of Congo. We had Peru, where we had a whole group of neighbors that eventually joined in because word of mouth had got around in Peru. We have the Ukraine, where we had a woman who was a visiting scholar who is finishing up her degree over there, and her niece who joins us from Kazakhstan. We've had Italy, we have Belarus. And taking what we learned in this, we're able to, at the start of this, also form another group. My coworker Kelsey and I, we took what we had learned from that breakout room and we applied it to helping people one-on-one with tech help. So we started using those breakout rooms as personal one-on-one counseling, where we would do everything from e-resources, but also basic computer assistance as well. Since we no longer had the computer lab, and it was sometimes really difficult over the phone to know what the patron was looking at, what kind of air screen they were having rather than seeing it. So we use these breakout rooms so we can actually assist multiple patrons at the same time. With that, we would use the screen mirroring so we could actually see what the patrons are seeing or guide them through on our side. And by doing that, we also found the remote control feature where we could actually take over their screen if we really did need to guide the mouse, guide them in a certain direction. our patrons in that group range from one-time assistants to regulars that we see every week. And they have grown so much from when we needed to call them on the phone to teach them how to use the Zoom versus now where they're like, I am comfortable. I want to learn how to use every resource out there. I want to be able to join programs. We helped a whole book club get on Zoom pretty much. There was about five members that didn't know how to work Zoom to get into their book club. So we helped them with that. We do a lot of e-resources, but we've also helped a woman install a new version of Windows on her phone. We helped them set up a printer. I helped somebody once, they were trying to figure out how to get Canopy on their TV. So one great thing about being able to do this digitally is they could actually walk us around their house, show us their computer screen, show us their TV screen, show us that printer, and we can actually look at that rather than if we were on the phone or even in person, they can't really bring a huge printer or TV in. So we've had a lot of success with that as well. And that is basically how we turn some of these in-person activities into online ones. And I will stop my share.
Great.
Thank you, Casey. That was really exciting. Yeah. It's impressive how many people are engaged from overseas. Again, I had no idea. That's really impressive. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Casey. I think I might need you guys to help me set up my printer too.
Uh-huh. That's exactly what I was thinking. Why am I struggling all by myself all the time?
Can I go ahead and start my part of the presentation? I'll go ahead and share my screen.
Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Erica Dean Glenn. I'm a senior librarian in Children's Services, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about children's virtual programming during the pandemic. Last year, around this time, we were just gearing up for our first virtual programming, and that seems like such a long time ago now. A lot of what we had to do in creating virtual programming has been about learning and making adjustments, whether it was due to feedback from a patron, seeing what other librarians were doing, or learning how to work within the parameters and limitations of the virtual environment. We started out with programs during summer reading last year. We really wanted to try to approximate the pre-pandemic offerings as much as possible. And so in concert with our summer reading program, we decided to go ahead and do some programming. And this picture here with the lady with the lovely flowers in her hair, that's Cascada de Flores. That was the very first virtual program that we did through Children's Services last June. And Cascada de Flores was wonderful in doing quite a few practice runs with us to get us started on Zoom. In discussions with Elliot Warren, he and I agreed that we really wanted to do live streaming programs to allow people to have that connection and interactivity. We started with two programs a month during the summer. And again, people really were craving the interactivity and connection. So we did a lot of our programs, actually all of our programs at the beginning were done in a meeting format so that we could see people, they could see us. People were typing hello in the chat and waving to each other. It was really a treat to see that. And it continues to be a treat to see all those smiling faces. So coming off of the success of our summer programming, we decided to continue to do virtual programming, live streaming programming throughout the school year. We're continuing with at least two live streaming programs per month, but we also said, you know, summer reading is a big cornerstone program of Children's Services, and so is story time. People expect story time. So we decided to do a virtual story time. And we premiered our first story time in August with the help of Vlad Kaplan, Amy Reeder, and former Library Services Manager Anna Gonzalez. All of the Children's Services librarians took part in an American Library Association training called Creating Outstanding Story Times to help us get ready for the transition to a virtual format. So here you see a screenshot of one of our more recent virtual story times. And initially we planned, as Vlad said, on having our story times air live on Facebook. We had 8 children's librarians and we wanted to pair them up so that the kids in the audience could see the librarians or their neighborhood librarians more frequently, so they didn't have to wait through a rotation of 8 librarians to see their neighborhood librarian. But so pairing up meant that we then also had to switch between librarians during the program. And this was another learning curve. In the course of many practice runs and much frustration, we learned that it was infinitely harder to try to simultaneously run the controls on Zoom, remember all the components of your story time, your songs, your finger plays, your banter, all the different things that you had to do during story time, and make sure it was streaming correctly, and also be engaging for the camera and for the people behind the camera. Luckily, Amy came up with the idea that we should pre-record and have our videos on do a premiere on Facebook. We also knew that although Vlad was training us on how to use all this new technology, we weren't going to be able to monopolize his time forever. So we got some training from Vlad on how to use the camera. And so that way, each of the children's librarians could learn how to record their own story times. That allowed us to put segments together from different people. We had guest speakers, a couple of staff members who shared stories and songs with us, in addition to the children's librarians. And we were also able to edit in transitions from one librarian to the next. Pre-recording also meant that if we recorded too much or recorded extra segments, we could save those for future use or if a librarian was not able to record 1 week. And here you see baby Emma enjoying one of our story times. And if you scroll way back on the Facebook page, you might see some videos that did not include books from the very beginning of our story time sessions on Facebook. But we quickly got feedback from patrons that yes, books were very much wanted and they wanted to have books included. We did some research and came up with a list of publishers that were flexible in their read aloud permissions. What we were worried about was coming up against copyright restrictions and read aloud permissions. A lot of librarians that I talked to were very much of the idea that, you know, this is all fair use, but we wanted to just make sure that we were being as cautious as possible. So we have our list of publishers now that we refer to when we are sharing our books. And here you see a close-up of baby Emma watching librarian Erin share a book with her. We also keep the videos up until the next one airs so that families and caregivers can enjoy the videos at their leisure over the course of the week. But we wanted to have a way that we could keep things up a little longer and also have people join us for short little bits and pieces of activity. So instead of having a whole story time, we came up with bits and pieces. And really it's just that, a collection of short videos featuring songs. And here you see librarian Michael with a few of our library staff and library friends. Movement, puppets, flannel boards, and more. With the help of Alicia Abramson, Vlad, Amy Reeder, and of course, all the Berkeley Public Library children's librarians, we developed the Bits and Pieces playlist on the Berkeley Public Library Kids YouTube channel. And this is the Berkeley Public Library Kids YouTube channel. If you go onto our YouTube channel right now, that is what you'll see. And it's got a lovely beautiful banner by Amy Reeder. And you see that we have our bits and pieces there. She's also added in some Reading is Instrumental posts, which is a program that the foundation put together. And we've been recording some programs also to include on our channel. Not all of our programs are able to be recorded for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that some of our performers or presenters will let us record maybe for a period of time and then we have to take them down so that they could actually share their program with other libraries and people won't just watch our videos and not have them at their other libraries. But we also have, again, our programs in meeting format. And to preserve the privacy of our patrons, we wanted to avoid having a kid accidentally unmute themselves and then show up with their face on the computer screen, which actually did happen during one of the programs that we were recording. And it was kind of tough to edit that out. We also have a program called Book Adventures that a group of librarians have been facilitating, and it's a deep dive into a topic through book lists. And here you see an announcement for our Resident Raptors, which is our Book Adventures program for this month. They put together book lists, discussion with local experts, videos, and activities all related to a particular topic. And I'm going to warn you, I'm about to show a picture of a pretty huge spider. This is from our very first Book Adventures program called Spider-Rama. This is an opening slide from one of our recorded programs. It's the Women in STEM series. And this was the very first one, S is for Science. And we have a variety of women come on and talk about their jobs in STEM and how they got interested in STEM, if they were interested in STEM as children, and then they lead a short activity with the kids. Also, we have coming up, Cooking Up a Story. And Cooking Up a Story is a program that was developed by Esther Suarez of Berkeley Reads. And she asked us to join in with her. So Esther creates a recipe, a simple, easy to reproduce, healthy recipe. And we read children's books that relate to that recipe in some form or another. And those will be going up on our YouTube channel as well. So we've been very lucky to have a wonderful array of performers and presenters through Zoom, from local presenters like Lourdes Rivas, a teacher and author, and the amazing Ethnotech storytelling group, but also people who we would have had a harder time having because of distance. So zooming in from Manhattan, we also had Kevin Noble Millard, who was is the author of the Seibert winning lovely book, Fry Bread, A Native American Family Story, and also a wonderful interactive family tap dance workshop led by Quinn Johnson of the Washington, D.C., Maryland area. And she had families up and on their feet and moving around, and also taught about the origins of tap dance and had people answering questions and asking questions in the chat throughout. We also have a really popular and well-attended kids yoga program, a kids yoga series that is also, again, interactive. And speaking of interactivity, we've also had our Take It and Make It craft series. Have crafts that are distributed at each location. With a huge thank you to the Central Children's Librarians and Patricia Heffron from West Branch for stuffing bags full of craft supplies for distribution to patrons. And also a big thank you to Una O'Cragley from North Branch, who created the origami flower craft that you see on the right. She adapted the instructions and came up with the idea. And you also see in this picture, it's actually a photo that a patron sent in to us of their finished craft. We've also had the Berkeley Public Library Lego Challenge, where each week we post a challenge where the kids have to build something and the kids respond with a response to that challenge. And in the picture on the right, you see one of our young patrons the challenge that he was responding to that week was build something in 1 minute. And another big thank you to Andrea Malarkey and her teen group, because they also have been participating in this challenge and kind of urging on the younger kids to also submit their responses to the challenge. We wanted to make sure that everybody, or as many people as possible, could participate in the Lego challenge. And we are aware that not everybody can afford Lego. So the foundation funded the purchase of 45 Lego sets that we then distributed to organizations such as Boss Harrison House. And in the center picture, there's me handing a box over to a representative from Harrison House, the Harrison House shelter, and also our Berkeley Reads Family Literacy group, families from the Family Literacy program. And on the far right, you see this guy right here is playing with some Legos, and he's one of the families from Berkeley Reads Family Literacy. So thank you very much for your time, and thanks to the Berkeley Public Library staff, the Friends of the Berkeley Public Library, the Berkeley Public Library Foundation, and everyone who supported our virtual programming, including our patrons.
Thank you, Erica. Exciting. Really interesting stuff. Thank you. So, Vlad and Casey and Erica, I want to thank the three of you for the presentation. I don't think we need to do anything except thank you. Mm-hmm. And Sophie, I see a hand.
Yes, thanks for not enthusiastic enough. This was so unbelievable. I mean, what an incredible body of work. I'm just one delightful, interesting, inventive, meaningful, worthwhile, awesome thing after another. It's just kind of exhausting to watch it all. I hope, you know, cramming it all into 20 minutes, it just seems like a massive amount of work, but I know it was, but hopefully spread over a little bit more than 20 minutes. But really, you know, the way that everybody has adapted so quickly, so creatively, and so fully to the challenges, and not just adapted, but, you know, I think really invented whole new and meaningful ways of doing the work of a library and connecting and engaging. I mean, honestly, it's, what do they say, that necessity is the mother of invention? And I think that's a silver lining to this time, is how creative people have been. And it's forced us to think about other ways to do our work and fulfill our mission. And I just, you know, it's stunning. So really, and even putting this PowerPoint together was a lot of work. So thank you for all of that. Thank you so much.
Amy, I see your hand.
Yes, I agree with Sophie 1,000%. Just to hear your enthusiasm and the degree that you engaged with these, you know, difficulties and your lack of fear, I think it's just really exciting, really wonderful, just great. And personally, I have listened to where the celebrity reads a little story and the Berkeley Symphony person. I've checked out a couple of those because I really like them. So they're just, but your whole presentation was excellent.
Thank you. Thank you all again. And keep up the good work. Thanks. Unless there are any other comments, we're going to move on in the agenda to Tess' report, an oral report about the trustee recruitment process and where we are with that.
First, I'd like to check and see, is the volume any better at this point? Are you able to hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat better. I'll try to project as best I can. So thanks very much. I do want to thank Casey and Erica and Vlad for their presentation before we move on. I've just been so impressed with what the staff at Berkeley Public has been able to do and produce in the past year and the impact that they've been able to have and the way that they've helped people and inspired people and continue to experiment and do new things basically every week. There's a new program that I can hardly believe is being developed. And I really want to make a point very briefly, which is obviously we've made a large investment in staff time and in the equipment that Vlad described, in all of the problem solving that Vlad and others have engaged in around the technological foundation that we have for this programming. And as important as our in-person programming is, and I know that everyone misses it very much, and we all want to get back to a time when we can provide that, I will also share that virtual programming has a place within the library. It makes a lot of things, it makes things accessible to people who may not be able to participate. It supports working people who may need to log into a program, you know, on our YouTube channel at a different time. And I think, as Erica pointed out, it's helped us connect with people that we normally would not have been able to feature, introduce to the public at the library. So I'm excited for our future conversations about what the right balance is, right? What's best in a virtual format, and when do we move toward our in-person programming? So I just wanted to tag that on. With respect to the trustee recruitment, thus far we've received notice of 3 completed applications by the city staff, and we're excited for that. And of course, the recruitment continues, and the closing date is actually May 24th due to the Malcolm X holiday falling on Friday, May 21st. So we're still very much actively recruiting and looking forward to receiving more applications. We have interviews for our applicants tentatively scheduled for June 14th is the placeholder date that we've established for that purpose. And all of the details with respect to our the role and responsibility of the Board of Library Trustees is available through our website. And of course, we're always happy to provide that information when people contact us directly. And we are really excited for this opportunity, excited for the opportunity to, you know, recruit another trustee that represents the diversity of our community, that may have connections with other community-based organizations or experience with boards, and also potentially somebody who might share a perspective of folks that we're trying to reach and support through the library. So perhaps somebody who has experience in small business or entrepreneurship. We're very excited for the potential applicants that we'll receive. So I don't know whether there are questions with respect to that, but I can definitely pause here and check with you.
Board members, any questions? Excuse me. Sophie, you have your hand up, but I think it was...
I'm sorry, I'm used to a chair that puts the hands down.
Oh.
I'm just used to that. At council, they put your hand down when they call on you, and so I always forget to do it myself here.
Yeah, I try not to do that. This is kind of self-serve here. Because I don't want to assume that somebody, I'm not sure sometimes. anyway, thank you, Tess. And then you're up again with the monthly director's report.
Thank you. I will try to keep it somewhat abbreviated. I provided a lot of wonderful information about some of the programs that took place in April and May that we're very excited about. I very much want to call out one program in our Farm to Shelf series that was produced by Esther Suarez, who was mentioned earlier, and Dan Berengeli. And it was a great program that they did in coordination with Berkeley Food Network, Fresh Approach, the Aging Services Division, City of Berkeley. And the focus of this program was on food insecurity and folks that are struggling with accessing food. And the program featured a recipe that you can make with ingredients that you could receive, for example, at a food bank. And I just wanted to say that I think this is a wonderful example of the kind of thing you can do with an online program and reach folks that may not be able to attend such a program and feel supported in terms of gaining information about local resources. So it was an important program. Another really wonderful series of programs that's taken place recently and is still underway is a really great collaboration with the Berkeley High School librarians. And we've hosted some wonderful authors, and these are teen author programs. And because we're coordinating with Berkeley High School, it means that we're able to reach hundreds more people than we might have normally done. We actually needed to coordinate a different kind of Zoom license in order to support these programs. And one of the things that's really fantastic about these is we've really connected with authors that represent a lot of the different identities that are represented in our community and in our schools. And so, for example, the first program that we did was with an author named Aiden Thomas, who identifies as a Latinx trans person. And the protagonist of his novel, Cemetery Boys, is also a Latinx trans teenager. And I think that this program was particularly powerful because our coordinator, Heather Cummins, was able to, with the help of librarian Jack Bauer, reach out and find someone in our community who could help moderate the panel in a really dynamic way, whose name is Hota Mercury, who's a local drag king performer. And so I think that the conversation they had made the program that much more dynamic and really reached a lot of youth that identify with these identities and also others. And I think that it's a great example of the kind of thing that we can facilitate with this great technology that we purchased and our multiple microphones and, you know, just making sure that we're able to provide the infrastructure for these programs. I wanted to discuss our reopening process because as has been mentioned earlier in the meeting, it's really wonderful that the city of Berkeley is at about 50% fully vaccinated. So of course, we're all thrilled for that. We're thrilled that people have now had the opportunity to access the vaccine. That's a very important step in preparing to reopen. And I just wanted to speak to the hard work and dedication of our staff who are so excited to provide service to the community and invite people inside. And we've got two wonderful teams with a number of different staff in each of the teams, focused on reopening our central library and also our branches. And the reason being just that the central library is considerably different from the branches, and we want to make sure that we don't miss details that would apply to one context and not the other. And this way the teams can collaborate and cross-reference. For us, it's really important that this planning process be as transparent as possible and that we have regular checkpoints with various staff groups around how the process is going. This includes discussions with our safety committee as well as our joint labor management team. And when we get to the point where we have more detailed plan to share, these will be vetted by these committees as well. We're working very closely with Kevin Walker, who is a fantastic City of Berkeley staff member and is actually the chair of the city's reopening team. because there are a number of decisions and details that will need to be consistent across city departments. So we want to make sure that the library's plans are consistent with what is generated by this committee as well. In addition, we'll be reaching out to Kevin to support us in terms of doing safety walkthroughs and reviewing our proposed workflows for when we do invite people inside. So something really exciting has happened, which is we've started providing some outdoor browsing off of carts at some of our locations. Some of you might have seen the carts at Torrey Hall Pittman South and Claremont, and patrons have just been thrilled. It sounds like at Claremont, they're needing to restock those carts with some regularity, which is exciting. And we're really happy that we'll be able to make, I think, a major announcement about reopening some of our locations for indoor service very soon. So please be looking forward to that. I do want to thank Trustee Hahn and Trustee Davenport for attending the staff meeting that we had recently. During the staff meeting, we did review some of our preliminary plans and some of our guiding principles. And I think it was an important time for staff to hear about some of the basically underlying values that we're applying in the planning process. And so the values include always making sure that we're prioritizing staff and patron safety, as we have all along. We're really making sure that the plans that we implement are sustainable with the existing staffing levels, the staffing levels that we have now. We would like to offer a variety of different services across our locations so that we're providing some variety that's accessible to different communities. And we also are applying an equity lens in examining which services we're providing and making sure that we're providing services that people in marginalized communities are really looking for. And we need to make sure that we can continue to serve people who may want to continue to access service outside, because we know that there are people that, regardless of the availability of vaccine, will not feel comfortable coming inside. And so we need to make sure that we can always provide or accommodate people who are accessing services outside. So we're very grateful to the staff that are focused on these efforts. It's a very intensive planning process, and we're excited to share more information soon about which locations will be opening first. It will be a phased reopening, so we will see some of our spaces reopening, and then the others will be coming online a little bit later. I want to thank Trustee Hahn for announcing and acknowledging that there will be a proclamation for previous Trustee Judy Hunt, and I will send out an email that has that link to the where folks can access that City Council agenda and make sure that they can link into that meeting so they can be present for the proclamation. I also wanted to thank the Berkeley Public Library Foundation again for support of our wonderful laptop and Wi-Fi hotspot lending program. We're excited to say that this officially launched on Monday, May 3rd. And so Berkeley Public Library is now making this equipment available. It's circulating, and we're trying very hard to make sure that people don't experience barriers to access in terms of checking out these laptops and Wi-Fi hotspots. I guess the final comment that I'd like to make is just with respect to our ongoing work around promoting a positive organizational culture, which is part of the vision that the Board of Library Trustees adopted last summer. And I think that this cannot be understated. It's I think, a really important part of culture change for Berkeley Public Library. And since Vlad is still here, I want to say thank you, Vlad. Thank you, Alicia Abramson, for providing more spaces on Bloop, which is our staff intranet site, to make sure that staff can see information that is conveyed to them. So positive comments from the public about the services they provide. So we created a little space called Library Love, which is basically where we collect all of the comments we've received from email, social media, sometimes could be phone, et cetera. And we place all of the comments on the staff intranet so that they're visible to all staff. Because prior to this change, we actually didn't have a mechanism for making sure that all of the staff saw these wonderful comments. And it's been, I think, at times overwhelming how many people have expressed appreciation for the services that staff provided during COVID. We're still getting positive comments from people about our outdoor pickup service, which we provided 6 days a week and also for very lengthy shifts as compared to some of our neighboring systems. And in addition, we did also staff and continue to staff a full-time reference line where people can call for reference questions, information needs they might have. So I think that the service we have been providing along with the virtual programming has been really important. And it's nice to see the positive experience of the staff reflected back in these comments, and we hope to continue to build on this. I think there are a lot of different ways that you can encourage staff recognition and positive organizational culture, but it's always good to take the low-hanging fruit where you can. Sometimes it's just about communicating those wonderful comments. So at this time, I will open it up to questions that you might have.
Questions?
Yes. I have a question. Tess, is there any way that Bolt can see those comments as well? We don't have access to Bloop. And so it's lovely for the staff to be seeing them, but gosh, I'd like to be seeing them also.
I love that idea. We have been embedding some of the positive comments in the library news, the internal staff newsletter that we've been providing, but I don't think it's been a comprehensive listing. So we could try to look and see whether we can, I'm not sure if we can sort of spit them out as a spreadsheet. It may not, but we'll kind of look and see what may or may not be possible with that. That's an interesting idea.
Even two or three in every newsletter would be great. Something's better than nothing, but it would be nice because I don't think we realize the breadth of the community that communicates with us many times, you know, and I think it's important for us as board members to remember there are a lot of people out there in really loving and supporting this library. We know that, but it would be nice to see it explicitly as well.
Thank you, Diane. Other board members? Go ahead, Amy.
This is in reference to the transition to online programming. I had kind of a late thought that I just want to share. A number of years ago, the San Francisco Opera was forced to perform in the Bill Graham Civic Center because the Opera House was being renovated or whatever. And a lot of people didn't like it and were afraid of it, but it resulted in some of the most innovative and exciting staging that I've ever seen. And your presentation made me think of that. It was just, they really made lemonade out of lemons, if you will. And that's what you guys reminded me of. Plus, actually, as a footnote, they're now performing in the Marin Civic Center parking lot. They have this huge stage and you drive your car in and you sit in your car and turn in the radio and they're singing in front of you. But again, it seems insurmountable, the problem, but then minds start to cook and they come up with something really great. And that's what you guys have done.
Thank you, Amy.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Tess. Thank you, Erica, Casey, Vlad. Mm-hmm. And if Dennis is still here, thank you, Dennis and Eve, all our staff. future agenda items and anything else to discuss? We have some meetings set, some special meetings. So we have a pretty busy schedule. Sophie.
Someone remind me again of the date by which applications for Bolt have to be in.
May 24th.
May 24th. Okay. That was my only last comment.
Thank you.
And we're going
to a little more than 2 weeks. Yeah.
We're going to recirculate that.
Okay, folks. Unless there's anything else, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. Eve, roll call.
John Salosky?
Yes.
Amy Roth?
Yes.
Diane Davenport?
Yes.
And Sophie Hahn?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you all for a very exciting, that was intriguing and exciting. It was wonderful. Thank you all.
It was a good meeting.
My entertainment.
Thank you.
Tonight.
Good night.
Thanks. Night. Take care, all.